Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 3:18 p.m. and that is Central Time, and today is July 16th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off with the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index because this is another failed upside break. And we know what failed upside breaks mean. It means that the price goes up to a new high and can't hold it. And generally speaking, when you have a range and you still have the sequence of higher reaction lows, so investors are not all that disquieted, but you have the failed upside breaks, it's telling us that the conditions for an upside breakout are not being met. In other words, that the vacuum of supply above the market has not formed. And then that begs the question, has the vacuum of demand formed below the range? So the price is starting to come back down again following another failed break upwards on Wednesday. And it did occur on some useful news, and it's that Taiwan Semiconductor is going to invest a lot more money in producing semiconductors, and that they're going to boost the supply of microcontrollers by 60% by the end of the year. Well, we're in the middle of July, so within the next 5.5 months, they are going to massively increase the supply of microcontrollers. So that's not especially good news for the semiconductor sector, because the supply of their product is going to increase. It means that the price and the margins that these companies have been enjoying will also likely decrease. And it helps to highlight once more just how cyclical this sector is. And when we then think about the course of the last decade, well, semiconductors have done frightfully well. So they've done well on the back of demand for consumer electronics. So that's been really, I think, pioneered by the advent of the smartphone. When we think about 2008, that was when the iPhone came out, and since then, we've really seen that there's been a continued upward trend in the performance of semiconductor shares. If we put it on a log scale chart, it becomes really very obvious. And we have the sequence of ranges one above another, and those ranges have lasted anything up to about 2 years. And the most recent one of those ranges was completed in 2019. We had the pullback into the region of the 1,000-day moving average and in 2020. And subsequently, we've had the widest overextension relative to that 1,000-day moving average in at least the course of the last 13 years. Well, therefore, it's increasingly likely that we're going to have a reversion back down towards that mean, or at least an additional pause. And it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we could move into a period of ranging that could last a couple of years, because even in the context of this environment that we've had of late, it looks quite likely that we're due at least some pause and consolidation. But when you start to put that together with the failed upside breaks, well, the failed upside breaks are not a concluding component of a type 2 top formation, but they're one of the most common characteristics and symptoms of topping activity. So when we see these upside breaks and the loss of momentum amid really fantastic enthusiasm towards what the prospects are for the long term, well, we have to at least pay some consideration to the potential that a lot of the good news has already been priced in. So we can think then about the kinds of companies that supply the kinds of the machinery required to produce semiconductors. So microchip technologies is certainly one of those, and it has top formation completion characteristics. It is pulling back below the lower side of the range It's broken its sequence of higher reaction lows. It's below the trend mean, and it's pulling back in a dynamic manner. It looks like a completed top formation. ASML has got a full book of orders that go out a couple of years, so they have a lot of visibility on what their earnings are going to be. But at the same time, the share is up from about 150 in 2019 to test the $600 area. When we think about the valuation, it's trading on an estimated PE of 47. But I think the more important point is that on a price to sales ratio, it's at 15. So this is an expensive share. And what is required in order for the trend to persist is that there has to be greater and greater visibility for sales going further and further out into the future. So obviously interest rates are going to play a part in that. And it's not like ASML has got a lot of competitors, so they are producing the most technologically advanced machines in the world, so they are likely to continue to have a special place in the technology sector, and that might well command a high valuation. But it failed to sustain the move above $600 in here today, and it's unlikely to be able to sustain that relative strength in the presence of a pronounced pullback among the leaders in the sector. So Nvidia has certainly also been a leader, and it's up in perhaps an even more aggressive manner. It was also trading around 150 in early 2019, and it has just failed to sustain the move above $800, and it was down aggressively in here this week. So that is at least suggesting that we are going to go back down and test the region of the trend mean. And I think the logarithmic scale chart is also useful here because the prior history looks meaningless when we think about the arithmetic scale chart. But the most important thing is that we'd had this extraordinarily lengthy range and then it broke out. So we've had a lot of companies that completed base formations in that period between about 2013 and 15. And some of those in the technology sector continue to do exceptionally well. And this may not be the top in Nvidia, but it's certainly a top. And certainly the potential here that this extraordinary environment where we've had a great deal of supply inelasticity is over, or that we're at peak supply inelasticity and that it just couldn't possibly get any better from here, in which case it could get worse for these companies because there is likely to be more competition. And with more competition, then margins are likely to compress. So then we can think about the very significant advance we've had in tin prices, because tin moved on to a new all-time high in here today. This LME price doesn't update until after, well after the close actually, but we're right in the region of the upper side of the range. Really, the price has been going mostly sideways since 2008. So half, or it's I think it's more like 60% of all demand for tin comes from the semiconductors sector. And then it means that soldering and tin cans, those the anti-corrosion uses for the metal are now in second position. So the big question, of course, will be how much will if we're going to continue to see supply of semiconductors increase and prices starting to come back down, then obviously, then we'll have a knock-on effect for perceptions, but it's also likely to be beneficial for the suppliers of components because there will continue to be an outsized demand for semiconductors, but as supply increases, prices come down, but they still require the raw materials. So that's likely to be beneficial for tin. But at the same time, the price is accelerating. So we could easily be see some pause in consolidation. When we think about some of the shares, well, there is the tin ETF in the UK, and that has pushed on to a new recovery high, and it was in clearly positive territory today. So we're certainly seeing this accelerating path here. And then we can also think about copper, because copper is a major component in batteries, and it's also a significant component in wind turbines. So the price also rocketed higher, and now we are getting some consolidation. So as we think about what the potential is, we also know that these metals do consolidate, but just because you get a consolidation, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's really going to be any major questioning of the secular bull market hypothesis. Because lengthy ranges conclude when you have a new demand growth story. So for copper, the new demand growth story is simple. It's that there are tons of copper required for wind turbines. And every electric vehicle that is purchased requires three times more copper than an internal combustion engine. So, on top of the conventional uses for the metal, that's a new demand growth story. And it takes years to develop copper mines. So, certainly there was a lot of money went into investing in new copper mines back in 2006 and 2007. Some of those ventures went bust, and some are starting to come to fruition. But it still requires a great deal of additional new supply. When we think about tin, well, it's not like demand for semiconductors is going to decrease. And this is one of perhaps the most important thing about markets. Demand is much less volatile than supply. And bull markets seldom end because supply evaporates. Instead, they tend to end because of the supply component. So we get a lot more supply coming into the market, and that ends the bull market in whatever that is. And that's potentially what we're seeing in semiconductors. But in terms of the supply, well, with increasing supply, then that is likely to also be beneficial over the medium term for tin, despite the prospect of potential for some pause and consolidation overall. Well, when we then think about what's been going on in terms of inflation, because it remains a very significant argument about whether we have temporary inflation, or what exactly does temporary inflation mean, or transitory inflation, I guess, is what they're talking about right now. Jeff Gundlach makes the, I think, the relevant point that when they used to talk about transitory, they meant 2 to 3 months. Whereas when they talk about transitory today, what they really mean is maybe 6 to 9 months. But one thing that's, I think, also relevant is when we think about the outlook for chips, well, it has contributed the most to inflationary pressures over the course of the last couple of months. So, as we think about where we are in this cycle, the significant investment in additional new supply is starting to manifest itself in additional products being made available. So, it's likely that at least this component of inflation is going to moderate. And of course, one of the other big considerations has been the lumber price. And lumber prices had been one of the primary fears for inflation at the end of the first quarter and into the second quarter, and the price has come straight back down. So back at the end of the first quarter, there were fears about the impact that this was having on the cost of manufacturing new homes. And there were stories about people who had been saving up to build their house, and then they couldn't afford to go ahead because of the rampant inflation in lumber prices. There were stories about people who had put down deposits for new homes and were being asked for additional deposits. And a friend of mine who bought in a new development in Las Vegas, he was saying that when he bought his home 2 years ago, he was one of the first people to move into the development, and he got all of the luxury finishes thrown in. And the people buying today for prices that are somewhere in the region of about 30 to 40% higher are getting none of those conveniences added in, and they're all additional costs. So certainly we've had some inflation in the cost of building homes, and that is now moderating. Well, that's potentially quite beneficial for home builders. They get to spend less money on building the homes, and then they get to take home bigger margins. But a lot of good news was priced in, and the sector continues to pause here as it reverts down towards the mean. So this, I think, is another example of how inflationary pressures are moderating. But I think it's also particularly important to pay attention here to what this other component is, which is the reopening components. So reopening components are a growing source of inflationary pressure, whereas all the way through 2020 they had been a disinflationary pressure. And if we then think about what that means, well, rising costs in terms of reopening businesses include being able to source inventory. So that has certainly been a challenge for businesses as they open back up again. The two kinds of inventory that are the two ways of measuring that inventory are relevant is the Baltic Dry Index, where we have a completed base formation. So the price was a little bit more negative yesterday, but as long as this is holding the breakout from the base, then we are in a new bull market environment overall. And the cost of shipping goods from China to the rest of the world continues to trend higher. Then we can think about the agriculture sector. When we think about agricultural commodities, they do tend to be volatile, but on an aggregated futures basis, this is a recovery overall. We have clear evidence of the trend being broken and support being found in the region of the trend mean, so agricultural prices continue to trend higher. So this clearly demonstrates that the cost of moving goods around the world is increasing, and the cost of those goods itself or themselves are also increasing. It's also relevant that this has broken a trend of compression from the peak in 2008 down to the lows in 2020. And these breaks of longer-term trends, they don't generally turn around quickly. So I think it's likely that we're going to have continued inflation in agricultural commodity prices and continued inflation in shipping prices. And there's a good reason why we would have inflation in shipping prices, and it's that companies like Maersk have said in plain English that they are going to pass on costs. And with the Europe announcing in here this week that they are going to expand their carbon credits trading system to include the automotive sector, the airline sector, and the shipping sector. Well, that's going to add an additional cost, and those costs are going to get passed on to consumers, whether directly in terms of prices or whether it means that there will be additional fees imposed. But one way or the other, those costs are going to get passed on, and it's going to feel like a tax. Now, obviously, there are arguments as to why it's necessary, but that is irrelevant in the short term because it will feel like a tax, it'll look like a tax, and it will be perceived as a tax. Now, when you have the Rhine reversing this, we have to remember that back in 2019 there were fears that the Rhine would run dry. And today it's breaking records for the last century in terms of flooding. So we've had a lot of volatility in the climate sector. Then you have continued risk of fires along the western USA, and that is as much about mismanagement of forestry as it is about dry conditions. But irrelevant, people have continued to conclude that that is only because of climate change. I think our answer is a lot more nuanced, but that's again largely irrelevant because it's an inflationary outcome. When weather becomes unpredictable, and when the volatility in weather outcomes, where we're getting 100-year events happening with such regularity, well, then we have to consider that the cost of producing commodities will increase. The cost of producing agriculture will also increase because it'll be more difficult, and we'll have much more variability in the yields from crops. So that's an additional tailwind for inflationary pressures. When we think about the difficulties of opening up, well, sourcing goods and materials is only one part of it. Sourcing people to work is another. So as we think about the difficulty that businesses are having in finding employees, well, one thing we can certainly say is, and I've noticed it myself on repeated occasion, that the quality of service at restaurants has been deteriorating steadily for the last month because the number of patrons has increased significantly, and establishments are having a great deal of difficulty finding new employees. So they're offering more wages, and wage demand growth on a month-over-month basis, though, is not trending higher. So we're seeing wages increase on a month-over basis by about 0.3%, and we're going to have to see a significant change in that pace in order to satisfy the demands of workers. What's happening at the moment is that the outsized unemployment benefits in the USA are rolling off, and that's going to have a knock-on effect because some people will be eager to get back to work, but the chances are that the people who were eager to get back to work are already working, and the people who were not eager to get back to work, well, it's either because they've been lumped at home with looking after the kids, and they just haven't been able to go to work, or they simply don't want to. So this is a significant question for businesses. How do you encourage more people back into the workforce? And they're going to have to start paying more money, or they're going to have to give people better conditions, which is one and the same thing in many respects. But maybe giving people better conditions is less of a cost burden, particularly in view of the pressures that come on families when kids are young, and of school going ages, particularly in the younger grades. So those kinds of changes that are happening in the economy are likely to have inflationary pressures. So then we have to think about the bond markets, because bond yields are now pushing back down below the trend mean. We've had a significant reversal in here this week, two big downward dynamics on Wednesday and Thursday, and now we're right in the region of the low put in at the beginning of this month. There's still a downtrend overall. The yield has encountered resistance around the 1.4% level. So we can then think about there are inflationary pressures, and is the bond market concluding that those inflationary pressures that are as a result of the reopening, are they going to be countermanded? And is the Delta variant going to be more of a risk? I saw a headline today that the number of patients in 49 US states is rising with the Delta variant. And then we have news that in Europe there is antagonism about differentiating between people who have been vaccinated and those who haven't, with street protests in Greece and in France. So we're certainly getting to a point where there's going to be a lot of disagreement. And of course, the vast majority of new cases are occurring among the unvaccinated. So regardless of how one feels about vaccinations, the reality is that they are working. Now, most people are more fearful about the long-term consequences of those vaccines, but from a market's perspective, the conclusion is simple enough that the vaccines do work, that a substantial proportion of the economy has been inoculated, and that represents a significant bulwark against a threat from any variant that's currently known. So these are, I think, some of the more important points. But nonetheless, bond yields are continuing to remain under pressure. And we will need to see that sequence of lower rally highs broken in order to confirm that we're back in a supply-dominated environment. If we flip it around and look at the bond prices, well, 10-year Treasury yields were well off their lows in here today, and so far at least, and particularly following the pop on the upside we've had over the last 3 days, it's increasingly looking like a first step above the base. And this is a very short-term view. And bunds are also trending higher, and we're continuing to push on the upside. When we think about the gilt market, well, UK gilts have also been reasonably firm and are pushing up and towards the upper side of this range. When we think about the Australian 10-year future, well, this is, I think, another example of the commonality that we're seeing in the market. So Australian bonds continue to rally, and the same can be said of Canadian bonds. So as we look at the performance of these instruments, bonds continue to rally. Investors seem to be reasonably happy to capture the yields that are currently available, and there's some risk of and certainly when we think about the semiconductors sector, it's been among the best performing sectors in the market over the course of the last 18 months, and it looks increasingly likely that it has peaked. And then we have fears about everything that's been going on. So I've seen numerous people talking about bubbles, and it's an interesting time to be thinking about that because usually a bubble occurs because of a policy mistake. So we might conclude that the policy mistake today has been that central banks provided too much assistance and they've been too slow in removing that assistance. And I think that's certainly there's some, I think, credible evidence to suggest that that might in fact be the case. But It's usually, and again, we can think about how do bull markets end? It's because supply increases and not because demand evaporates. So it's supply increases and it overwhelms the available demand. And the demand can be affected at the margin by interest rates. But if bonds are rallying, it means that bond yields are compressing. So if the technology sector is weak against that background, it means that there is an underlying problem that needs to be identified and addressed. So it's looking likely that the semiconductor index has peaked and that it will have a knock-on effect for perceptions about what we might anticipate from the rest of the technology sector. However, I think it's important to differentiate between hardware and software, because when we think about hardware, well, there's nobody buying a subscription, and there's no such thing as hardware as a service. What we have is software as a service, and we have evidence of subscription business models smoothing out the cash flows from businesses. So when we then think about the potential, well, the Nasdaq looks overbought and it's susceptible to some additional weakness. And I think that when we think about Microsoft, well, they have been the company that have been standout performers because they adopted a subscription business model back in 2013. The advent of Microsoft 365 was a transformative event, and it has been realized in terms of this extremely impressive bull market. Well, Amazon, with its Prime and the reliability of cash flows it gets because it charges for Prime in much the same way that Costco charges for its membership, well, then that creates steady cash flows. Netflix is an outright subscription business model. Then we can think about Adobe being the first company to adopt a subscription business model. So we have short-term overbought conditions just about everywhere, but some portions of the market are at much greater risk than others, and I would think that we're going to get a very clear delineation between the performance of hardware versus software, because software companies generally tend to have higher margins, and supply becomes less of an issue. So they generally tend to cater to demand. Doesn't mean that software companies can't decline, and it's likely that we will have at least pause and consolidation, and not least because ETFs represent such a large proportion of investors overall. So if ETFs are unlikely to differentiate between various portions of the market, it would suggest that we are due at least some pause and consolidation here. Then it's, I think, worth also highlighting that the VIX index has a higher reaction low, and it's been really firm now since the beginning of July. So then we can go back and look at the Nasdaq, or well, I think more correctly, if we're looking at the VIX, we should look at the S&P 500. Well, the S&P hit a new high just 3 days ago, and it has been going higher despite the fact that the VIX has been going higher. That's a pretty odd set of circumstances. So when volatility is rising without a significant response from the stock market, it suggests that people are taking on additional insurance and that investors are not paying any attention to that. Well, they're starting to pay attention. So I think it's likely that we're going to have a process of mean reversion, and that we're going to move into a lengthier period of consolidation overall. And that is also feeding through into demand for treasuries, and that the dollar remains quite steady. Well, I'm going to post a report in here today where it's got these extraordinarily long charts of interest rates dating from the early 1300s and going onwards. So, interest rates have been falling throughout that time, and that's despite the large number of wars. We might think about it as that bonds are a market for risk, and therefore, if bond yields have been compressing, it means that risk has become, or the assessment of risk has become more efficient. So the debt markets have become progressively more efficient over time. Of course, we're now also at a situation where the quantity of debt outstanding in the USA is larger as a percentage of the global total than at any time since the early 1300s, when Italy accounted for the vast majority of all developed market debt. This paper from the Bank of England does not include places like Japan or China, so it's not a truly global comparison, just simply because we do not have the data. But the dollar is at a point where one has to conclude that we have seen meaningful support come through around the 90 area. I remain bearish over the medium term. I continue to think that the US is going to spend a great deal of money to ensure that the dollar does not appreciate a lot. But at present, the pace of vaccination and the outlook for the Delta variant around the world is perhaps the abiding characteristic that most people are looking at, and the high rate of vaccination in the USA is acting as a fundamental support for the US dollar. Now, when we think about other portions of the technology sector, the Bitcoin price has been ebbing over the course of this month, and it's come right back down to test the lower side of the range since the beginning, or really the middle of May. So generally, we've seen over the course of the last month that the weekends have returned positive performances. So it wouldn't be all that surprising to see some volatility and perhaps beneficial activity in the Bitcoin price. But the challenge for Bitcoin is that you have people like Jay Powell saying that when you have a central bank digital currency, then there won't be a need for these types of tokens. So that's going a little bit further than they've been willing to talk about before. And it is a real big shot across the bow for the big bulls of Bitcoin. And I think there's been a lot of talk about the stock to flow charts, and that has been one of the most reliable ways of predicting prices over the course of the last 5 or 6 years. But never paid any attention to the law of big numbers, because with Bitcoin at $63,000 for one, then the asset had a market cap of $1 trillion. And in order to get to 120,000, well, it would have to have a market cap of $2 trillion. And that money has to come from somewhere. So it's either going to siphon money out of existing assets, or it's going to benefit from the creation of new money. So that has to be a big question for anyone who is very bullish. Where's the money going to come from to support a run up to new all-time highs? Obviously, there is the potential for extraordinary volatility on both the upside and the downside, and prices could as easily go to 60,000 as they could to 15,000. So you can either have a halving or a doubling, and that kind of one-to-one and is not really the kind of risk reward ratio that people really are attracted to. So we're at an interesting point for Bitcoin because the challenges that lie ahead for it are increasingly political in nature. And it has increased to an extent that it's becoming a potential threat. Or at least, at the very least, it has highlighted to central banks just what they can gain from adopting more fintech. Because from the perspective of a central banker, they want to know as much as they can about how money moves through the economy. And they have written just massive quantities of paper have been devoted to trying to figure that out. And they've never really had effective tools to tell them how money goes through the system. And they are often frustrated by the failure of money printing efforts to move out into the economy. And certainly, we've seen over the course of the pandemic that central banks have gone one further, and instead of simply supporting the corporate sector, they have put money directly into the pockets of consumers. So that resulted in a massive swell of savings. And that's not really what they wanted. So some people used all of that new money to pay off their debts, and that's really good for them. But the other I think point is that central banks want stimulus money to be spent. They need the velocity of money to increase. And the stimulus checks that went out were partially successful in achieving that. If they could do more with less, then it would be a more effective policy and it would be less expensive. So if they knew where that money was going, and they knew what people were doing with that money, not perhaps in isolation, but in aggregate, well, then they could have a better way of sending stimulus out into the economy and ensuring that it has the kind of effect that it's designed to have. Well, digital currencies provide that kind of insight. So it's quite likely that one way or the other, we're going to have central bank digital currencies because it represents a technological innovation where they believe that they could have a much greater influence and that they would have greater intelligence and they would be able to do their jobs better. From a private individual's perspective, giving government agencies greater insight into what I own, how I'm spending it, and what my spending patterns are, that's a massive intrusion in terms of privacy. And of course, the more assets one has, then the bigger a target one becomes for governments trying to figure out how to fund their giveaways in terms of fiscal policy. So eventually, there will have to be tax hikes. And it would make a lot of sense to find the people with the most money and take it off of them, because that's a crowd pleaser more often than not. And eventually, and unfortunately, you can't talk to people about these kinds of events. People have to learn them themselves. They have to first experience inflation, and then they'll be willing to understand and to take the lessons of history on board that inflation robs you of your savings, not increases your savings. So you need to have the higher interest rates, and then that is what savings returns come from. When inflation has been vanquished and interest rates are still high, then you get positive real interest rates, and savers do exceptionally well. But before we ever get to that point, savers are going to get denuded of their returns, and it's likely that central bank digital currencies will be a big component of how the new taxation and monitoring regime is implemented. So the significant advances that have been made in terms of negotiating a global tax on investments and the disclosures that will be incorporated into that so that countries know which companies are making money, where they're making it, and how they're spending it and repatriating it. Well, all of that will factor through into digital currencies as well. And the challenge with Bitcoin, for anyone who wants to try and keep their assets away from governments, well, it's that it's a public ledger. So it's really not all that difficult to find people, particularly if they bought their Bitcoin on an exchange. If one is mining oneself, well, then that's a different story. So the shares of mining companies should start to do better, but only to the extent that Bitcoin does better. If one is gaining a greater market share in a declining market, well, that's not particularly something that is inspiring for investors. But if one were gaining a greater market share in a rising market, well, then that's exactly what people would want. So Riot Blockchain's been investing in new mining infrastructure, and certainly the profitability of mining has increased for Bitcoin as the price has come down and as fewer miners are performing the operations because of the ban on mining in China. But then we can think about the gold price, and gold was in negative territory today, and the big question for investors is whether that low around $1,750 is the low. And if it holds, and we see this weakness that started today starting to ebb, and that demand starts to come back in next week, well, then we would have a higher reaction low. And if this is a higher reaction low for gold, well, it would suggest that the corrective phase that began in August of last year is over, and that we are moving back into a new demand-dominated environment. Silver prices have been extremely inert over the course of the last 3 months, and they are now right in the region of the trend mean. So it would be a very convenient area for support to be found. Then we can think about the platinum price. And platinum has rebounded pretty impressively over the course of the last 3 weeks, and it's now right in the region of the trend mean, but it continues to hold that $1,000 area. And as long as it's doing that, this entire range over this year can be considered to be a first step above the base. It looks likely to me that gold is likely to be in a bull market, and that it will attract additional flows as people question just how well Bitcoin can fulfill its objectives of anonymity and outsized performance. Gold can be anonymous, so it's something that will attract investors. And diamonds are also anonymous. And we've had a significant advance in diamond prices. This does look like a new bull market. And it looks, in many respects, exactly like the agricultural commodities. So I don't exactly know what the link might be between the two things, but there is certainly a high degree of commonality. And both are perhaps responding to inflationary pressures. So it's easy to think that we have transitory inflation because semiconductor prices are probably going to come back down, and lumber prices have already come down. And because semiconductor availability is improving, then the shortage in the automotive sector is going to also improve. Then we can think about the rest of the economy and the continued bull market that we have in Moderna, because they are looking increasingly towards deploying their solution to more problems. They believe that having proven that mRNA is a broad spectrum solution to an intransigent problem, that they can use that data to tweak it so that they can then go and look at other challenges. Now, if that proves to be the case, then that will revolutionize the drug discovery trend overall. Historically, drug discovery has taken years, and going through phase one, two, and three trials, and even getting up to the point where you get to do human trials, has been incredibly time-consuming. So, the innovation of mRNA, coupled with deep learning, and coupled with genetic editing, well, those three factors combined are revolutionary in terms of drug discovery. So we're in a potentially at least a new environment, and it is likely to be beneficial for a relatively small number of companies. So Moderna continues to push on the upside, and Intellia Therapeutics surged higher 3 weeks ago, and it's now unwinding at least part of that, but it's because, or it surged on the upside because they are looking at releasing their first drug, and they also claim to own the patent for CRISPR gene editing technology. Editas also has a claim on that, and so does CRISPR Therapeutics, but it looks like Intellia is the one that is making the running at present. So it's a rather interesting environment because not every one of the biotech companies is an mRNA candidate. So it's likely that if Moderna succeeds in revolutionizing the speed with which drugs can be brought to market, then every biotech company will be doing it. And that transition will benefit some and perhaps not others. It suggests that the ETF may suffer, whereas individual companies might do better. So it's, I think, turning into more of a stock picker's environment. I think when we look at the space sector, it's a very similar environment because we can think about legacy satellite companies. So Intelsat was one of those companies, and it went bust, and now it's got a new ticker. So it was looking like it would go bust, and then it didn't go bust. It went like up like a rocket in 2018 because they thought that they might be able to sell their bandwidth for 5G. And there was a lot of speculation that there would be a reclassification of some of that bandwidth, and then it didn't happen, and they aren't able to make their bond payments, so the share has collapsed. And the problem for a lot of existing space companies and those satellite companies is that they put up long life satellites and they hoped to be able to earn dividends off them for the full life of those satellites. Whereas today, the rockets being sent up by SpaceX can launch 30 or 50 or 100 nanosatellites, and the technology for those satellites is does not last as long, but the cost of putting them up there is so much lower that they're easy to replace, and the technology in them is improving so that they are lasting longer. So that's terrible news for the legacy portion of this market. But then we can think about, well, what do you put in a space ETF? Well, you have to go off and look at the existing portions of the economy because of the of this part of the economy. And the problem is that most of them don't make any money. And they are less likely to make money because of the innovation that's happening in the private sector. Because the space company that everyone wants to own is SpaceX, and it's not listed, and it doesn't look like they have any plans to list it. And perhaps the second one that people want to own is Blue Origin, and Jeff Bezos doesn't seem to have any intention of listing that either. Virgin Galactic had, or they stole a march on Jeff Bezos last week by launching their pleasure craft first, and the share collapsed. And then Jeff Bezos announced that he's going to buy the company, close it down, and just absorb the engineering team. So the share is coming back down again. And this is makes for a very difficult environment. So there is incredible promise from the space sector, and it's likely that we're going to have incredible innovation. Now, Planetary Labs is coming up for an IPO, and they have been successful in selling satellite data to all manner of different companies, but perhaps the most, I think, one of the sector that will perhaps do best from the new advances that we're getting in satellite technology are the miners. Mining is an incredibly uncertain prospect, and a lot of the money that goes into exploration turns up to really doesn't make any economic sense. But there's no way around it. The reality is that you dig a lot of holes and hopefully you find something. And you go to places where stuff has been found before, and hopefully you'll find it again. Well, Goldcorp revolutionized the interpretation of data. They did a whole load of drilling, and they wanted to know where was going to be the best place to dig, so they open sourced it, and they came back with some answers from people on the internet who analyzed all the data and gave them the best places to dig, and Goldcorp subsequently became one of the biggest gold miners. Well, if one has ground penetrating satellite data and a big computer, or at least open sources the data and allows people online to compete to interpret it and pay them for it, well, then the job of a junior miner becomes quite a bit easier because they can drill with more accuracy, they can reduce their costs, and that kind of innovation is something that could really transform the mining sector. And we're going to need these kinds of innovations because there is a shortage, and industrial resources prices are rising, and there will have to be a new investment cycle. And for investors to get on board, they would really like to have all their ducks in a row. Well, they're starting to get around to the idea of ESG and to try and tick the boxes for the climate and for social and environmental governance, certainly. But companies also have to make money. And that suggests that it's the mining sector is probably going to benefit most from all those satellites that are getting thrown up. So we're in an interesting environment. We have incredible innovation that is coming through in the healthcare sector and in deep learning and in the autonomy sector. And Tesla has released their latest prototype for autonomous driving. Now, the share has been pausing, and it's not going to be immune from weakness in the wider technology sector. So I think we are likely to have a shakeout, and then the first to find support will be those that will lead us up and away. But before that, we will probably need to have some kind of shakeout in the broader technology sector. So we're at this interesting juncture where there is incredible excitement, but The uncertainty around the world at the rise of the Delta variant, personally think is a little bit overdone. Because we can look at what happened in India, and certainly it was incredibly traumatic for about 2 weeks, and the number of cases peaked and then came straight back down again. So even that being a worst case scenario, that's what we see around the rest of the world, then that's relatively short term in nature. So perhaps we see that the weakness that's starting to emerge in the technology sector is confined to a reversion to the mean. But it does suggest that this is a time to sit in one's hands rather than to plow in and buy what's a very short-term dip. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.